This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, my kids are back in school, Congress is back in session, and we're back on the air at the start of what is sure to be an exciting next few months in healthcare. There are lots of benefits kicking in at the end of this month as states are taking steps to set up their health insurance exchanges and temporary high-risk pools. And of course, midterm elections loom large coming up in November. You know, I saw a CNN poll from late August that said 83% of Americans considered healthcare an extremely or very important issue in determining their vote for Congress.
Well, we'll be following the ramp up to those midterm elections very closely. Obviously, that's going to have a big impact. I hope everybody enjoyed their summer. We're happy to be back. We hope you stayed healthy and cool, which was hard to do in large parts of the country this summer.
It was.
And out in California, they were busy getting a head start on setting up their health insurance exchange. The legislature passed the bill, which Governor Schwarzenegger is expected to sign later this month, making California the first state to set up the health insurance exchange, hopefully paving the way for other states that can take action early.
Looks like Governor Schwarzenegger, who's finishing up his second term, has a healthcare vision for California, and he wants to do as much as possible in that regard before he leaves office next January. He included a high-tech telehealth system to be included in California's $60 billion infrastructure development program. The California Telehealth Network is intended to connect patients, mostly in underserved areas, to hundreds of hospitals and clinics statewide using broadband technology.
Now, Mark, you and I have talked to some of the leaders in their pilot programs. Mm-hmm. They've really done an extraordinary job, and we look forward to the rest of the country getting to follow. And while California stands out, one place we haven't heard much about in the way of healthcare is our nation's capital, healthcare for the people who live in our nation's capital, that is. But according to D.C.'s Health Reform Implementation Committee, they're now moving ahead as well. They've already expanded Medicaid coverage in the district, a key component of the new healthcare reform law that will be required in 4 years by all states in which they go up to 133% of the federal poverty level for coverage.
Well, that makes D.C. and Connecticut the only two jurisdictions so far to have expanded Medicaid coverage early. And while we're talking about our home state of Connecticut, I'd like to announce that here at the Community Health Center, we've just launched a national campaign to address childhood obesity. It's called Recess Rocks. It's both a contest and a program. Check us out at recessrocks.com. I think you'll be very excited about our offerings.
That launch coincides with the first ever National Childhood Obesity Month, and there could be no better topic to focus on. It is the number one threat to the health of children, and in economic terms, it also threatens to swamp our healthcare system. Today, let's turn to our guest who joins us from our nation's capital. Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen is the Murdoch Head Professor of Medicine and Health Policy at George Washington University. He's a practicing pediatrician at the Upper Cardozo Community Health Center in Washington. He has a career that spanned 40 years. 40 years ago, he wrote his book, White Coat, Clenched Fist, went on to be a physician in the National Health Service Corps, and later served as its director. We're delighted that he can join us today.
But no matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chcradio.com. You can subscribe to iTunes to get our show regularly downloaded, or if you'd like to hang on to our every word and read a transcript of one of our shows, come visit us at chcradio.com. And now you can find us on Facebook. You'll find the button on our website, or you can search Conversations on Healthcare Radio Show.
And as always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Now, before we speak with Dr. Mullen, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, for the headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. The administration announced the first round of applicants accepted into the Early Retiree Reinsurance Program. The program provides financial assistance to employers and unions to help them maintain coverage for early retirees. Nearly 2,000 employers have been accepted into the program and will begin to receive reimbursements for employee claims this fall. According to a new survey of state data by USA Today, a record number of American citizens are enrolled in government anti-poverty programs. More than 50 million Americans are on Medicaid. That's up at least 17% since the recession began in December 2007, and that number is only expected to grow. Speaking of healthcare and the economy, the National Bureau of Economic Research published a new study that found that the poor economy has caused Americans to cut back on routine medical care compared to countries that provide universal health coverage to its citizens, countries like Britain, Canada, and France. 26.5% of Americans who responded to the survey reported reducing their use of routine medical care since the start of the global economic crisis. The percentages in countries with universal coverage were far less, only 5.3% in Canada, 7.6% in Britain, and 12% in France. Today on Conversations on Healthcare, we're discussing the importance of the primary care workforce. Now that healthcare reform is passed, experts are trying to figure out how to provide care to the millions more Americans who will gain coverage. One report published in the August issue of Health Affairs hints at just one way we could possibly go about expanding the healthcare workforce. For a long time, international medical school graduates have been filling the gaps in the U.S. physician workforce. International graduates, for example, now account for nearly 30% of all primary care doctors, a specialty, as we're all aware of, that has struggled to attract American medical students. The Health Affairs study evaluated the records of more than 200,000 patients who were hospitalized for either congestive heart failure or heart attack. After examining how their outcomes correlated with their doctor's education and background, researchers discovered that patients of foreign-born primary care physicians fared significantly better than patients of American primary care doctors who received their medical degrees either here or abroad. Patients of foreign-born international medical graduates had the lowest death rates. Patients of U.S. citizens who attended medical school in other countries had the highest death rates. And U.S.-born and trained doctors fell in the middle. John Norsini is the president of the Foundation for Advancement of International Medical Education and Research. He says the study should ease some of the concerns people have had over the years about how good the regulatory process is for international medical graduates training in the U.S., as well as the care they give their patients.
There's no difference between international medical graduates as a group and U.S. medical graduates as a group. So I think the takeaway is that given the limitations of the study, the regulatory process seems to be working well.
Even if international medical students are not the answer to the primary care workforce shortage in the U.S., Norsini thinks it should give patients reassurance nonetheless. Let's turn now to our interview with Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen, who can give us his thoughts on building a strong primary care workforce and a better healthcare system for all populations, something he has worked his entire career to establish.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen, a physician, educator, and public health leader whose career has spanned more than 40 years. He's currently the Murdoch Head Professor of Medicine and Health Policy and a professor of pediatrics at George Washington University and a practicing physician at the Upper Cardoza Community Health Center in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Dr. Mullen.
Glad to be here.
Your career has spanned 40 tumultuous years in healthcare, and your book, White Coat, Clenched Fist, was described as a memoir, but you wrote it in 1976, still early in your career, about the injustices in the healthcare system. Along with many others, you've made the elimination of those injustices, which lead to profound health disparities based on race and income and insurance, a cornerstone of your work. From your perspective today, what has been accomplished and what do you see as the key battles still to be won?
Well, I'd start by saying I do think we've made progress. Things are, I think, a good deal better in terms of equity than they were 40 years ago. I say that without any sense of a braggadocio, but to look at the evidence that suggests we're doing better. I think the huge racial gap in the country is hard at this point in time to appreciate. You have improved statistics in a variety of ways, improved health outcomes among African Americans in particular, which, despite the gap that still remains, represent major steps forward and something of a closing of the gap. I think you have, in terms of health career opportunities, a fairly serious, fairly coast-to-coast effort to improve opportunities for disadvantaged and underrepresented minority students, which was not the circumstance. I went to medical school, graduated in 68. We had one non-white student, and he came from Nigeria.
Well, much of your work and writing has certainly focused on the whole issue of training and education of healthcare professionals, and particularly primary care providers. And you've written about the impact of graduate medical education caps, about the role of non-physician providers in primary care, and also the need to reform medical education generally to prepare for the demands of the 21st century. So certainly a major focus of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act is the healthcare workforce. We'd be interested in your thoughts on whether that bill went far enough to address the issues of looming primary care provider shortages, and whether you think the remedies prescribed, expanding the National Health Service Corps, which you were once the director of, loans and scholarships, community-based residencies, are the right ones to address the problems, or did you have recommendations that did not find their way into the legislation?
In regard to workforce, I think we got some very appreciable new tools. The increase in the size of the National Health Service Corps, coupled with the increase in the size of the funds available for community health centers, really will provide a much stronger and much less porous safety net, I think, a few years out. The incentives for primary care, I actually think the toughest long-term issue for the country is the whole issue of generalist care. And developing both a workforce as well as a patient population that will appreciate the importance of generalist care, which we call primary care, but it's a generalist approach, is a real challenge because the incentives have all been laid the other way. So on making those incentives and rebuilding ones that will make primary care as attractive a career as specialty care and make populations understand the importance of having good generalist care for prevention, for education, for dealing with 90% of what ails all of us all of the time, getting that message through is a really tough one.
Dr. Millen, I want to get back to that, your fellow student from Nigeria, because you've been equally concerned with workforce issues abroad. And while foreign-trained doctors make up an important part of our healthcare workforce, the issues of equity in other countries, especially poor countries, are aggravated when we deprive these countries of trained doctors. And as we try to find ways to expand and diversify our healthcare workforce now that millions more will have insurance when the exchanges roll out, will this only get worse? And what are the alternatives that you are contemplating?
Well, we've developed an enormous dependence on international or foreign-trained health workers, not only in medicine, but in nursing and pharmacy, home health care. We've done it because it's been cheap and easy, and it's conformed to the needs of institutions who want quick labor, training institutions who have not been able to obtain or haven't sought the additional funding they need to build themselves fully out or start new institutions. And finally, of course, the foreign workers are eager to get into this country. What we need to do is wean ourselves from our dependence on foreign labor for two reasons. One, it's not good for us, and secondly, it's not good for the countries who are paying to train folks only to have them siphoned off after the investments have been made in them to the industrial world, ourselves in particular. It's what I call reverse foreign aid. I mean, we're busy giving out foreign aid on the one hand, and particularly in health and medical education, and then on the other hand, we're setting up a market situation that sucks that labor right into our country. Not good for the country, either country involved. The answer to it is being much more attentive to the educational requirements that it will take to build a workforce of the size and type that we need. And that means long-term educational funding and investment, which we at the federal, state, local, and personal level have been remiss to do.
Dr. Mullen, I think of you as one of the individuals who brought the concept of community-oriented primary care into the mainstream of healthcare, a focus on the needs of a community, on a defined population of patients, and responding to the needs of that population based on data and based on the wishes of that community. And as we struggle with the obesity epidemic, I'm always reminded of how important that is. That approach requires both a strong public health system as well as a strong personal healthcare system. So I'd ask you, would you modify or redefine the concept of community-oriented primary care for today's healthcare needs?
I recently reviewed a volume that Jaime and Rosa Gofin, G-O-F-I-N, have published on community-oriented primary care and community-oriented public health. They're expanding the concept. I thought it was an interesting expansion. My own belief, and maybe I'm old school, is that the basic principles of COPC, community-oriented primary care, are valuable, viable, and way underused. And the essence of it is using public health precepts in the pursuit of clinical practice. Most of us work one-on-one, not only in our use of time, we're seeing patients one-on-one, but we also think one-on-one and have little reference to what the larger picture is in our community or in our region or in our state, and what the larger numbers tell us about the likelihood of a given condition being prevalent in our population. COPC invites the practitioner to be cognizant of the bigger picture and spend his or her energies, not just clinically, but in the efforts of the practice or of the enterprise that the doctor as a whole or the clinic as a whole undertakes, community interventions, specific campaigns, the ability to know the bigger picture even as you pursue direct patient care will make you and your practice more efficient. That's COPC, and I think it has a great deal to offer in all aspects of our system.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen, Professor of Health Policy and Pediatrics at George Washington University. Dr. Mullen, you've written numerous books and articles on medical and health policy topics. You were the original editor of a popular column, Narrative Matters in Health Affairs, which features first-person narratives and stories that illuminate often complex health policy issues. And you still serve as a contributing editor, but can you tell us what that type of contribution, that type of writing adds to healthcare? Is there evidence to suggest that it makes doctors or healthcare providers better practitioners?
Certainly, there's been a robust response to the column in terms of people writing, wanting to tell their stories, clinicians and others. Additionally, there's been numbers of reader surveys and others of health affairs, and it's always rated very high. Many say they read it first on the premise that the premise we started it on, that it's often easier to get a policy message packaged in a
story
than it is, say, in a table or a statistical approach. Both obviously have their role. We're not against formalized evidence, but the human tradition of telling stories has been around since man started, and will be around, I dare say, as long as we are.
I'll admit to being one of those people who read Narrative Matters first. So, Dr. Mullen, let me, if I can, return to that book that you wrote, White Coat, Clenched Fist, for a moment. It's a title that captures the anger and the activism of a generation of young students of the health professions. And I read a review of that book from somebody who wrote about the vulnerability of the ill, even for doctors when they're sick, saying that there are rarely clenched fists in a hospital bed. I think that's a pretty good metaphor for new doctors and nurses in today's healthcare system, where the stress and the demands are overwhelming and maybe not so conducive to activism. From your perspective, do you see that call to action and activism in the students you work with today that many of us felt early in our careers?
Well, that's a good question, Margaret. I get asked that from time to time. I think it waxes and wanes a little bit in terms of the tenor of the country as a whole. What I will say is I think that the idealism resident in health profession students is always catches me by surprise. I mean, when you can sit back and think about, well, they weren't as active as they were, they ought to be, or whatever. And then you sit with a group of students who are concerned about an issue and are willing to put in their nights and their weekends or their summers to do something about it, it is always energizing for me. And that reservoir is there. I think today, interestingly, the enormous outpouring of interest in global health, and particularly in Africa, is a manifestation of that. I've often wondered, is it out of frustration with our own country, that the sense of motion, or put it differently, the sense of frustration for those trying to change and improve the system has been so battered or beaten about that the opportunities to make a difference abroad have an appeal that they mightn't if things were moving better or quicker here. If indeed the current legislation begins to move and change the system, will the opportunities for students to become more active, not just in protesting, but in terms of staffing, working with and helping to improve the system, will they return home? Will we repatriate them? I think it'll be interesting to see.
Speaking about where we go and Africa and points beyond, when you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovations, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
We are in an effort of burgeoning once again, or developing new health institutions, health professions institutions, particularly in medicine. After 25 years with no new medical schools, there are now some 12 allopathic schools and roughly an equal number of osteopathic schools that have either come online recently or coming online very shortly. A number of these have fairly innovative and new models in terms of their educational mission. I like to think of them in terms of Flexner and post-Flexner, with Flexner being the 100th anniversary of the Flexner Report. Mm-hmm. Flexner, for all the success he had and brought to us in terms of quality, regularizing, standardizing medical education, which was all over the lot before him, it also highly specified, limited, and arguably rigidified it, so that many students who were not first-rate test takers and scientists were denied admission. I think we're seeing innovations that are looking beyond that, and places like the A.T. Still School in Flagstaff, Arizona, an osteopathic school which is using community health centers as the basic teaching platform for the latter 3 years of medical school.
Today, we've been speaking with Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen, the Murdoch Head Professor of Medicine and Health Policy and Professor of Pediatrics at George Washington University, and a practicing physician at the Upper Cardozo Community Health Center in Washington, D.C. Fitzhugh, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea comes to us from Massachusetts, where three health centers are experimenting with a new tactic for combating obesity, prescribing more fruits and vegetables. The project, Prescription Produce, centers on doctors prescribing their patients coupons from local farmers markets. The coupons amount to $1 a day for each member of the patient's families. Although farmers market voucher programs have been used in Massachusetts for decades, this project is unique, because it specifically targets obesity, and doctors actually write prescriptions that are filled at farmers' markets rather than simply issuing coupons. The target patients are obese or at risk of becoming obese, and most live in neighborhoods where healthy produce is expensive and hard to come by. The project's goal is not only to increase patients' access to fruits and veggies, but in the short run, to increase daily consumption of these essential foods by one serving a day. On a larger time scale, participants hope patients will establish consistently healthier eating habits. The pilot project will include 50 families at three Massachusetts health centers. The project's designers see this program as vital because long-lasting health improvements will only endure if an increase in fruits and vegetables is coupled with an equal or decrease in sugary, high-fat processed foods. So patients will learn how to make better diet choices while receiving the resources to make those choices a reality. To gauge the pilot's success, doctors will monitor their patients' eating patterns and attitudes, body mass index, and weight change. The Ceiling and Visibility Unlimited Foundation, which sponsors the program, is also working on expanding it through a year-round partnership with local grocery stores so that the closing of our farmers market in the winter will not set patients back. By increasing immediate access to essential fruits and vegetables, the Massachusetts Prescription Produce Project is tackling obesity head-on and helping people establish lifelong healthy eating habits. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.